at this gay club on their daughters' jerseys. One day, long into the protest, Richard Stein was in his bar when one of the most conservative Turkish residents, a woman who wears the full niqab, gave him some cakes. He opened the box. Out of icing, on top of one of them, she had made a little rainbow flag. But while Koti and Co were coming together, the evictions were continuing. One day, Nuria met a woman rather like herself. Rosemary was in her 60s, mostly confined to a wheelchair, and she was being evicted from her home in another part of Berlin because she couldn't pay the rent anymore. She had suffered a lot in East Germany under the communist regime, Nuria remembers. She was tortured and she wasn't healthy. She was mentally ill, she was physically ill. It moved me that this woman was being kicked out. So Nuria decided to take more direct action. When she heard an eviction was happening, she would go there, often with Tanya, and she would use her large electric wheelchair to physically block the entrance so the bailiffs couldn't get in. I got so angry, I decided to block the door any way possible, she says. When the police came and tried to physically remove her, she said she'd just had an operation to remove her gallbladder, which was true. I said, if you touch me, if anything happens to me, I have all these witnesses around me, it's going to be very bad for you. I'm not going to resist, I'm not going to curse you, but what you are doing is wrong. Don't touch me. You could see in their faces this is not what they've been expecting, Tanya told me. A protest like that, having a Muslim woman in a wheelchair not moving and not being afraid of them. They had all their stuff on, looking like Darth Vader, and she just sits there in her wheelchair and smiles and says, I will not move. But Rosemary was thrown out of her home. 2 days later, in a cold homeless shelter, she died of a heart attack. Nuria herself was, not long after this, forced to leave her home too, although after a long and frenetic hunt, the community found her another apartment only a short journey away. So Koti and Co. stepped up their organising. They protested more. They argued more. They marched more. They attracted more media. They dug into the financials of the companies that owned the homes and found that even the city's politicians didn't understand the ludicrous contracts that had been drawn up so long ago. And then, one day, a year after their protest began, the news came through. Thanks to Koti's political pressure, their rents would be frozen. There was a guarantee they would remain at the same rate. This didn't happen at any other housing projects in Berlin, but it happened here. It was a direct result of their activism. Everyone was thrilled, and yet, when I spoke to people, they told me they no longer thought of the protest as being only about the rents. One of the Turkish-German women at Koti, Neriman Tunka, told me she had gained something so much more important than a low rent. It led her, she said, to realise how many beautiful people are living all around you as your neighbours. They had been there all along, but they had never seen one another. And now, here they all were. When they lived in Turkey, the women there had referred to their entire village as home. And when they came to Germany, they learned that what you are supposed to think of as home is your own four walls and the space within them, a pinched, shrivelled sense of home. But as these protests erupted, their sense of home expanded once again to cover the whole housing project and the dense network of people who live there. As Neriman said that to me, I wondered how many of us, in our culture, are, by the standards of Koti and Co., homeless. How many of us, if we were thrown out of our homes or we were carted off to a psychiatric institution, would have dozens and dozens of people standing by our side, protecting us. This is the heart of this protest. We are all going over the limit by caring for one another, one of the protesters told me. By caring for one another, we grew. Over the samovar, Mehmet told me that if this protest hadn't happened, he would have dropped out of high school. He said he learned, here is something you can lean on, and together we can become strong. I'm so happy I got to know so many beautiful people. Tanya told me, we all learned a lot. I can see something through the eyes of another person, and that's a new source of meaning. We're like a family. Another of the protesters, Sandy, told me the protest showed how weird it is, the idea that we should all sit apart from one another, pursuing our own little story, watching our own little TV, and ignoring everyone around us. It's normal, he said, that you care. I sometimes think that people at Cotty & Co. think I'm crazy, because I would turn up every now and then, sit with them, listen to their stories, and at some point I would start to cry. Before the protest, Sandy noticed that a lot of people are depressed, he said. They pull back, highly depressed, on medication. They were sick, ill, because of these issues. Nuria had been so depressed she was going to kill herself. But then, as he put it, because of these protests, they became very political people again. It's like therapy for us. One of the protesters, Uli, told me that at Cotty, they made themselves public. At first, when she said this, I thought it was a slightly clunky translation in her otherwise perfect English, but then I thought about it more, and I realised she'd actually found the ideal words for what they did. They had stopped being solely private. They had stopped sitting alone. They had made themselves public. And it was only by doing that, by being released into something bigger than themselves, that they had found a release from their pain. 2 years after Nuria first posted her plea for help in the window, when I arrived there for another visit, I found that the people from Cotty had teamed up with other activists across Berlin to step up their struggle. In the German capital, you as an ordinary citizen can trigger a referendum for everyone in the city to vote on if you gather enough signatures on the street from people who say they want it. So the people I met at Cotty fanned out across the city, approaching other Berliners to get them to sign up for a referendum that would keep rents low for everyone. It was a package of lots of reforms, more subsidies, elected boards to control the housing system, a commitment that any money made from the system would go towards paying for more low-cost social housing, and an end to the evictions of poor people. They gathered the largest number of signatures for a referendum in the long history of the city of Berlin. The members of the Berlin Assembly, panicked by the radicalism of the proposals, approached the people at Cotty and the others who'd organised the referendum and offered to cut a deal. If you withdraw the referendum proposal, they said, we'll agree to most of what you want. If you don't, when you win, we'll challenge the result in the European courts for breaching European competition law, which would hold up the reforms for years and years. They offered a smorgasbord of changes. If you were poor and couldn't afford the rent, you'd get an extra subsidy of €150 a month, a large amount for a poor family. Eviction would be reduced to the absolute last resort and become rare, and the management of the housing companies would from now on have elected members of the residents on the boards. It wasn't what we wanted, Matty told me, but it's a lot. That's a lot, definitely. On my last day in Cotty, I sat outside Café Zublok, and many of the characters from this story wandered around me as I sat with Tanya, who was chain-smoking happily in the cold sunshine. The protest site across the street is now a permanent structure. It'll never be taken down. Some Turkish women were drinking coffee, and some kids were kicking a ball around them. As she inhaled, Tanya told me that in modern society, if you're down, you're made to feel, she said, it's only in your house. It's only you. Because you didn't succeed. You didn't get a job where you earn much more money. It's your fault. You're a bad father. And then suddenly, when we went on the street, a lot of people realised, hey, I'm the same. I thought I was the only one. It was what a lot of people told me too. I'm feeling so lost and depressed, but now okay. I'm a fighter. I feel good. You come out of your corner crying, and you start to fight. She blew her smoke away from me into the air. It changes you, she said. You feel strong then. Chapter 16. Reconnection 1. To other people. In most parts of the Western world, Nuria would have been told there was something wrong with her brain chemistry. So would everyone else in Cotty. They would have taken their pills and stayed alone in their little apartments until they were thrown out and scattered. I never felt more keenly that this story was wrong than at Cotty. They taught me that when people start to rediscover each other, problems that previously seemed insoluble start to look soluble. Nuria was suicidal. Tunkai was shut away in a psychiatric hospital. Mehmet was going to be thrown out of school. What solved their problems? It seemed to me it was other people standing by their side, committed to walking on the path with them, finding collective solutions to their problems. They didn't need to be drugged. They needed to be together. But this was all just an impression. So I was left with two questions. Is there any scientific evidence that changes like this reduce anxiety and depression beyond the anecdotal stories of the people I met there? And is there any way we could replicate it beyond the unusual circumstances of COTTI? After I read about one important area of research into this, I went to Berkeley, California, to talk with one of the social scientists who carried it out, a brilliant woman called Brett Ford. We met in a coffee shop in downtown Berkeley, which is seen by the outside world as a font of left-wing radicalism. But on my way to meet her, I passed lots of young homeless people, all begging or being ignored. Brett was tapping away frantically on her laptop when I arrived. She was, she explained, in the middle of applying for jobs. With her colleagues, Maya Tamir and Iris Mouse, both professors, she'd begun, several years before, conducting some research into a pretty basic question. They wanted to know, does trying consciously to make yourself happier actually work? If you decided today, now, to dedicate more of your life to deliberately seeking out happiness, would you actually be happier a week from now or a year from now? The team studied this question in four countries: the United States, Russia at two different locations, Japan, and Taiwan. They tracked thousands of people, some of whom had decided to deliberately pursue happiness and some of whom hadn't. When they compared the results, they found something they had not expected. If you deliberately try to become happy, you will not become happier if you live in the United States. But if you live in Russia, Japan, or Taiwan, you will become happier. Why, they wanted to know, would that be? Social scientists have known for a long time that, to put it crudely, there's a significant difference between how we think of ourselves in Western societies and how people in most of Asia conceive of themselves. There are lots of little experiments you can carry out to see this. For example, take a group of Western friends and show them a picture of a man addressing a crowd. Ask them to describe what they see. Then approach the next group of Chinese tourists you see. Show them the same picture and ask them to describe it. The Westerners will almost always describe the individual at the front of the crowd first, in a lot of detail. Then they'll describe the crowd. For Asians, it's the other way round. They'll usually describe the crowd, and then afterwards, almost as an afterthought, they'll describe the guy at the front. Or take a picture of a little girl who is smiling broadly, in the middle of a group of other little kids who look sad. Show it to some kids and ask them, does this girl in the middle seem happy or sad to you? Western kids think she's happy. Asian kids think she's sad. Why? Because the Western kids have no problem isolating an individual from the group, whereas Asian kids take it for granted that if a kid is surrounded by distress, she'll be distressed too. In other words, in the West, we mostly have an individualistic way of looking at life. In Asia, they mostly have a collective way of looking at life. When Brett and her colleagues looked deeper, this seemed to offer the best explanation for the difference they'd discovered. If you decide to pursue happiness in the United States or Britain, you pursue it for yourself, because that's how you think it works. You do what I did most of the time. You get stuff for yourself, you rack up achievement for yourself, you build up your own ego. But if you consciously pursue happiness in Russia or Japan or China, you do something quite different. You try to make things better for your group, for the people around you. That's what you think happiness means, so it seems obvious to you. These are fundamentally conflicting visions of what it means to become happier. And it turns out, for all the reasons I described earlier, that our Western version of happiness doesn't actually work, whereas the collectivist vision of happiness does. The more you think happiness is a social thing, the better off you are, Brett explained to me, summarizing her findings and reams of other social science. As Brett talked me through this research, I realized what I had been seeing at COTTI all along. They had shifted from an individualistic vision of how to live, shut yourself in your home, accumulate stuff for yourself there, to a collectivist vision of how to live. We're a group, we belong together, we're connected. In the West, we've shrunk our sense of self to just our ego, or at most our family, and this has made our pain swell and our happiness shrivel. The evidence suggests that if we return to seeing our distress and our joy as something we share with a network of people all around us, we will feel different. And yet this bumped up against something I'm a little bit embarrassed to confess. When I started work on this book, I wanted quick solutions to my depression and anxiety, ones I could pursue on my own, fast. I wanted something I could do now for myself to make me feel better. I wanted a pill, and if the pills didn't work, I wanted something as brisk as a pill. You, as a listener who's chosen a book about depression and anxiety, probably want the same. When I discussed some of the ideas I was putting forward in this book, one person I know said I'd just been taking the wrong pill. You should, he said, try Xanax instead. I was tempted, but then I realized, how can we say the solution to all the understandable pain and distress I've been describing is to take a tranquilizer and for millions more people to take it forever? Yet, if I'm honest, that's the kind of solution I craved. Something individual, something you can do alone without any effort, something that takes 20 seconds to swallow every morning so you can get on with life as it was before. If it couldn't be chemical, I wanted some other trick, some switch I could flip to make it all fine. What this evidence was telling me was that this search for quick individual solutions is a trap. In fact, this search for individual solutions is part of what got us into this problem in the first place. We have become imprisoned inside our own egos, walled off where true connection cannot reach us. I started to think of one of the most banal, obvious cliches we have. Be you. Be yourself. We say it to one another all the time. We share memes about it. We say it to encourage people when they're lost or down. Even our shampoo bottles tell us, because you're worth it. But what I was being taught is, if you want to stop being depressed, don't be you. Don't be yourself. Don't fixate on how you're worth it. It's thinking about you that helped to make you feel so lousy. Don't be you. Be us. Be we. Be part of the group. Make the group worth it. The real path to happiness, they were telling me, come from dismantling our ego walls, from letting yourself flow into other people's stories and letting their stories flow into yours, from pooling your identity, from realizing that you were never you, alone, heroic, sad, all along. No, don't be you. Be connected with everyone around you. Be part of the whole. Don't strive to be the guy addressing the crowd. Strive to be the crowd. So part of overcoming our depression and anxiety, the first step and one of the most crucial, is coming together as they did at Cotty and saying in effect, what we've had up to now isn't enough. The lives we've been pressured and propagandized to live don't meet our psychological needs for connection, security, or togetherness. We demand better, and we're going to fight for better together. The key word in that sentence and in how they fought is we. The collective struggle is the solution, or at least the essential foundation for it. At Cotty, they got some of what they demanded at the start, but not everything. And yet the process of coming together to fight for it gave them a sense that they weren't broken up individuals, but a collective. I'm conscious that in some bookstores, this book will be shelved in the self-help section. But I now saw that whole way of thinking is part of the problem. When I felt down, up to now, most of the time, I tried to help myself. I turned to the self. I thought there was something wrong with the self, and the solution would come from repairing and aggrandizing the self. I puffed it up. But it turns out, the self isn't the solution. The only answer lies beyond it. My desire for a solution that was private and personal, the psychological equivalent of a pill, was in fact a symptom of the mindset that had caused my depression and anxiety in the first place. After I learned this, I made a conscious decision to do something differently. Until I learned this, when I felt depression and anxiety start to set in, I felt a panicked need to keep my head above water. So I would try to do something for myself. I would buy something or watch a film I like or read a book I like or talk to a friend about my distress. It was an attempt to treat the isolated self, and it didn't work very often. In fact, these acts were often the start of a deeper slide. But once I knew about Brett's research, I saw the error I'd been making. Now, when I feel myself starting to slide down, I don't do something for myself. I try to do something for someone else. I go to see a friend and try to focus very hard on how they are feeling and making them feel better. I try to do something for my network or my group, or even try to help strangers who look distressed. I learn something I wouldn't have thought was possible at the start. Even if you're in pain, you can almost always make someone else feel a little bit better. Or I would try to channel it into more overt political actions to make the society better. When I applied this technique, I realized that it often, though not always, stopped the slide downward. It worked much more effectively than trying to build myself up alone. Around this time, I learned about another area of research that had implications for this question, so I decided to go and see its subjects for myself. I saw my first Amish buggy on the wide, flat plains of Indiana as I whooshed past in a car going 70 miles an hour. By the side of the highway, a man with a long beard and black robes was sitting on top of a horse-drawn carriage. Behind him there was a child and two women in bonnets who looked to me like refugees from a BBC historical drama set in the 17th century. Against the vast flatness of the American Midwest, where there's nothing on the horizon except more horizon, they looked almost like ghosts. We had been driving for 2 hours out of Fort Wayne, the nearest city, and now Dr. Jim Cates and I had arrived in an Amish town called Elkhart-Lagrange. Jim is a psychologist who carries out psychological assessments on Amish members who've broken the law. Although he's English, which is the Amish term for everyone outside their group, he's a rare outsider who's been part of the community for years. He agreed to introduce me to people there. We started to walk through the town, past a lot more horses and women dressed in the exact same style of clothing that their ancestors had worn 300 years ago. When the Amish came to the United States back then, they were determined to live by a simple fundamentalist vision of Christianity and to reject any new developments that might interfere with it. That determination has persisted, so the people I was about to meet take no electricity from the grid. They've got no TV, no internet, no cars, almost no consumer goods. They speak a language that's a variant of German as their mother tongue. They rarely mix with non-Amish. They've got a separate school system and a radically separate value system from the rest of the United States. When I was a kid, I lived not far away from a community of ultra-Orthodox Jews who were a bit like this in some ways. And as I passed them in the street, I was always baffled. Why would anyone live that way? As I got older, I developed, if I'm honest, a contempt for any group that rejected the benefits of the modern world. I saw them as crazy anachronisms. But now, as I was reflecting on some of the flaws in how we live, I wondered if they might have something to teach me after all, especially because of one key piece of research. Freeman Lee Miller was waiting to meet us outside a diner. He was in his late 20s, and he had a medium-length beard. Amish men start to grow it when they get married. Almost before we started speaking, he pointed to something a little distance away. Right over there, that red-green roof, that barn right there, that's where I grew up, he said. As a kid, he lived there in a little collection of houses, arranged around one another, together with four generations of his family, running right up to his great-grandparents. Their electricity came from batteries or from propane gas, and they could travel only so far as they could get on foot or by buggy. This meant that if one adult wasn't around, you had another party to steer you the right way, he said. You're constantly surrounded by adults and other kids, so yeah, I definitely got enough attention, he explained. They didn't have a concept of spending time with the family, because you were always with the family. Often, spending time with the family was going out and working in the fields or milking the cows. Other times, it meant the constant family time of eating and social events. An Amish family isn't like an English family, he explained. It's not just your mom and dad and siblings. It's a big interconnected tribe of about 150 people. All the Amish, in fact, who live within walking or buggy distance of your home. There's no physical church for the Amish. You take turns gathering in different people's homes for the Sunday service. There's no permanent hierarchy at all. People also take turns serving as pastor, and it's allocated randomly. We're going to have church in our house Sunday, he said, and there will be his immediate family, but also all the other rings of Amish members, some of whom he knows very well, some of whom he knows only a little. So, as he said, it just builds another relationship. It's all about connection affection in our community. I guess that's where we go in a crisis. All of a sudden, you've got people showing up. When they turn 16, all Amish have to go on a journey, one that makes them curiously well-equipped to comment on our culture. They have to go and live in the so-called English world for a few years. It's called going on Rumspringer, and out there, they don't follow the strict Amish rules for an average of 2 years. They get drunk, they go to strip clubs, or at least Freeman-leaded, they use phones and the internet. Lee told me he always thought someone should launch a brand of rum named Rumspringer. And then, at the end of their youth spurt, they have to make a choice. Do you want to leave all that behind and come home to join the Amish church? Or do you want to stay out in the world? If you stay out in the world, you can still come back and visit, but you'll never be an Amish. Around 80% choose to join the church. This experience of freedom is one of the reasons why the Amish are never regarded as a cult. It's a genuine choice. Freeman Lee loved a lot of things about the outside world, he told me. He still misses watching baseball games on TV and listening to the latest pop songs. But one of the reasons he came back is because he believed an Amish community was a better place to have children and to be a child. Out in the world, he felt like, he said, you're always just hustling. You got no time for family. You got no time for kids. He couldn't understand what happens to kids in a culture like that. How do they grow up? What kind of a life is it? I asked him how his relationship with his kids would change if, say, he got a TV. We could watch it together, he says, shrugging. We could enjoy TV time together. It still doesn't do justice compared with going out in the backyard. Even if it's just going to clean the buggy together, it doesn't do justice. Later, I went to see Lauren Beachy, an Amish man in his early 30s who works as an auctioneer, often selling off things taken from repossessed homes. We sat in his front room, surrounded by books. He loves William Faulkner the most. And he explained to me that you can only understand the difference between the Amish world and the outside world if you understand that the Amish have consciously chosen to slow down. And they don't see that as a deprivation. He knew I had just flown in from thousands of miles away, he said. And he explained, I'd like to fly to the Holy Land, but our church has agreed we don't fly. It keeps us slower. It keeps the family more together. Because if we fly, then I can fly to California to do an auction and then fly back. Whereas now, that's not practical, so we're at home more. But why, I wanted to know, would you choose slowness? You lose something when you slow down, Lauren said, but he thinks you gain more. You gain, he said, that sense of the local next-door neighbour community. If we had cars, then our church district is going to be scattered across 20 miles. We wouldn't live right beside each other. The neighbours wouldn't come over for supper so often. There's a physical closeness, and as a result of that, a spiritual or mental closeness too. The automobiles and airplanes are ever so convenient, and we see the convenience to that speed. But as a group, I suppose we've decided to resist it so that we can instead have a close-knit community. If you can be everywhere, in vehicles or online, you end up, he believes, being nowhere. The Amish, by contrast, always have, he said, a sense of being at home. He gave me an image to describe this. Human life, he says, is like a big warm coal fire that's glowing. If you take out one coal and isolate it, it'll burn out quickly. We keep each other warm, he says, by staying together. I would have loved to be an over-the-road trucker and see the country and get paid and not have to sweat, he says. I would have loved to watch the NBA playoffs every night. I like watching That 70s Show. I think they're hilarious. But they're not hard to give up. As we talked longer, he started to compare the Amish to the groups out in the English world all around them, like Weight Watchers, where you gather together to lose weight and support each other. You'd never be able to resist all that food on your own. But as a group, banding together, checking each other, encouraging each other, you find you can. I looked at him, trying to process what he was saying. So I asked, you're saying the Amish community is almost like a support group for resisting the temptations of an individualist civilization? Lauren thought about it for a moment, smiled and said, that's one big benefit, yes. After everything I've been learning, I found being among the Amish disorientating. As a younger man, I would have dismissed all this as just backwardness. But a major scientific study carried out on Amish mental health in the 1970s found that they have significantly lower levels of depression than other Americans. Several smaller studies since have backed up this finding. It was in Elkhart-Lagrange that I felt I could see most clearly what we've lost in the modern world, and at the same time, what we've gained. The Amish have a profound sense of belonging and meaning, but I could also see that it would be absurd to see the way they lived as a panacea. Jim and I spent an afternoon with an Amish woman who begged the community to help her when her husband was violently abusing her and their sons. The church elders told her it was the job of an Amish woman to submit to her husband, no matter what. She continued to be violently abused for years before she finally left, scandalizing many in the community. The group was united in ways that were inspiring, but it was also united by an often extreme and brutal theology. Women are subordinated, gay people are treated appallingly, the beating of children is seen as a good thing. Elkhart-Lagrange reminded me of my father's village back in the Swiss mountains. It had a profound sense of community and home, yet that home often had vicious house rules. It's a sign of how potent community and meaning are, that when they're added to the scale, they could even, for some people, seem to outweigh the real and terrible pain these problems cause. Is this, I wondered, an inevitable trade-off? Does gaining individuality and rights inevitably undermine community and meaning? Do we have to choose between the beautiful but brutal togetherness of Elkhart-Lagrange and the open but depressed culture of Edgware where I grew up? I don't want to abandon the modern world and go back to a mythical past that was more connected in many ways, but more brutal in many more. I want to see if we can find a synthesis in which we move closer to the togetherness of the Amish without suffocating ourselves or turning to extreme ideas that are often abhorrent to me. To get there, what would we have to give up, and what would we gain? As I continued to travel, I began to find places and techniques that I think might offer the beginning of an answer. Sitting in the middle of Amish country, Freeman Lee told me he knew his world would seem strange to me. "I understand how you guys would look at it," he said. "But our thought is, you can have a little bit of heaven here on earth if you just interact with other people. Because that's how we imagine it to be, you know. When life comes to an end, if you get to heaven, it's interacting with people. That's how we look at it. If your picture of a perfect afterlife is being with the people you love all the time," he asked me, "why wouldn't you choose today, while you're still alive, to be truly present with the people you love? Why would you rather be lost in a haze of distractions?" Chapter 17. Reconnection 2. Social prescribing. I could see why so many people at Cotty were released from depression and anxiety, but their circumstances seemed unusual. How, I kept wondering, could you replicate their move from being isolated to being connected? It turned out the answer, or at least the first hints of one, had been just a few miles away from me all through my depression, in a little clinic in the poorest part of London. They have, they believe, found a model for how to spread it much more widely. Lisa Cunningham sat down in her doctor's office in East London and explained that she couldn't be depressed. Then she burst into tears and realized she couldn't stop. "Oh my goodness," her doctor said, "you are depressed, aren't you?" As the pain seeped out of Lisa, she thought, "This can't be happening to me. I'm a mental health nurse. It's my job to solve problems like this, not succumb to them." She was in her mid-30s, and she couldn't take it anymore. For several years, up to this day in the mid-1990s, she'd been working as a nurse on a psychiatric ward in a leading London hospital. That summer was one of the hottest in the city's history, and there was no air conditioning on her ward. They were trying to save money, apparently, and she had been sweatily watching as things went more and more wrong. Her ward treated people with all sorts of mental health problems serious enough to require hospitalisation, from schizophrenia to bipolar disorder to psychosis. She had become a nurse because she wanted to help those people, but it was becoming clear to her that the hospital she was in just wanted to drug people to the eyeballs. One young man was brought in with psychosis, and he was drugged so heavily that his legs were shaking all the time and he couldn't walk. Lisa watched as the man's brother had to carry him on his back from his bedroom so he could sit and be fed his lunch. One of Lisa's colleagues mocked him by referring to an old Monty Python sketch. "Oh, it's a ministry of funny walks around here, isn't it? Look at his legs," she said. Another time, a patient became incontinent, and another nurse reprimanded her in front of all the other patients. Oh, look, she's pissed herself, she said. Oh, God, can't you get to the toilet in time? When Lisa complained that they were not treating the patients like human beings, she was told she was being oversensitive, and before long the other nurses started to turn on her. Lisa had grown up in a home where there was a lot of aggression, so for her, this dynamic of being picked on and put down felt both familiar and unbearable. I went into work one day and I thought, I can't face being here, she told me. I'm sitting at my desk looking at the computer screen. I couldn't do anything, physically couldn't do anything, and I said, I don't feel very well. I'm going to have to go home. When Lisa got home, she shut the door to her house, crawled into bed, and wept. She stayed there, essentially, for the next 7 years. A typical day for Lisa during her long depression was to wake up at midday, sick with anxiety. Real, real anxiety, she says. She would obsessively think, what do people think of me? Could I go out? You know, I lived in the East End of London. You couldn't go out your front door without seeing people. Day after day, she would put on makeup, try to steel herself to go out the door, and then take it all off and collapse back into bed. If it wasn't for the fact that her cats needed food, she might just have stayed at home and wasted away. Instead, she'd bolt to the little shop 5 doors down, stock up on cat food and massive quantities of chocolate and ice cream, and hurry back home. Just before she was signed off sick, she started taking Prozac, and on the drugs, she began to put on enormous amounts of weight. She ballooned to 16 stone, about 224 pounds. She was obsessively eating chocolate ice cream cake, bars of chocolate, and not a lot else during the daytime, she said. When I sat with Lisa years later, she still found it hard to describe those years. I was completely disabled by it, she said. All the things that I'd been confident doing up to that point went away. I used to love dancing. When I first moved to London, I got a reputation as being the first person to get up and dance, so I used to get into the clubs for free. Oh, is that Lisa? Let her in for free. She'll be dancing soon. But all of that went with depression. I felt I'd lost me. I lost my identity completely. Then one day, her doctor told her about a new idea somebody had come up with and asked if she would consider taking part. One afternoon in the mid-1970s, on the grey western coastline of Norway, 2 17-year-old boys were working in a shipbuilding yard. They were part of a team constructing a large boat. The night before, there had been high winds, and to prevent the crane from toppling, they had attached it using a grappling hook to a large immovable rock. But the next morning, somebody forgot that the crane was still attached. So when a workman tried to move it, the boys heard a loud creaking sound, and the crane suddenly began to fall in their direction. One of them, Sam Everington, managed to throw himself out of the way. He watched as the young man next to him disappeared beneath the crane. There's key moments in life when you think, shit, I'm going to die, Sam told me. After that moment, watching his friend die, he made himself a promise. He wasn't going to sleepwalk through life. He was going to live fully. And that meant refusing to follow other people's scripts, to try to cut through to what really matters. Sam thought of that moment when, as a young doctor in East London, he felt uncomfortable because he kept noticing something that he wasn't meant to notice. Many patients came to him with depression and anxiety, and he'd been told by his training how to respond. When we went to medical school, he explains, everything was biomedical. So what you described as depression was due to neurotransmitters. It was a chemical imbalance. The solution then was drugging. But that didn't seem to match the reality of what he was seeing. If Sam sat and talked with his patients and really listened, the initial problem, the idea of something going wrong inside their brains, very rarely ended up being the real issue that mattered to them. There was almost always something deeper, and they would talk about it if he asked them. One day, a young EastEnder came in who was feeling really down. Sam took out his pad to give this man pills or refer him to a social worker. The man looked at him and said, I don't need a fucking social worker. I need a social worker's wage. Sam looked at him and thought, he's right. I'm wrong. He thought back over his training and realized, as he put it, I'm missing something. Everything he'd been trained for was, he said to me later, missing a massive part of the solution. His patients were often depressed, he realized, because their lives had been stripped of the things that make life worth living. And he remembered his pledge to himself as a young man. So he thought, if we're going to respond to depression honestly, what do I do now? Lisa walked for the first time into the doctor's centre that Sam was helping to run. The Bromley by Bow Centre is located in a concrete crevice of East London, sandwiched between some ugly housing projects close to the end of a huge traffic tunnel. She felt painfully self-conscious. She'd barely left the house for years. Her hair had grown out and become curly and unkempt. She thought she looked like Ronald McDonald. She was sceptical that this new programme would help, or that she would be able to bear being around other people for long. Sam's plan, working with a group of like-minded people, had been simple. He believed that something was going wrong for his depressed patients, not primarily in their brains or their bodies, but in their lives. And if he wanted to help make them better, he had to help his patients change their lives. What they needed was to reconnect. So he was part of a team who helped to turn this doctor's office suite into a hub for all the volunteering groups in East London as part of an unprecedented experiment. When you went to see your doctor, you didn't just get pills. You were prescribed one of over 100 different ways to reconnect with the people around you, with the society, and with values that really matter. What Lisa was prescribed was something that seems almost stupidly modest from the outside. Around the corner from the medical centre was an ugly scratch of scrub and concrete that the locals dubbed Dogshit Alley, a messy place that contained nothing but weeds and a broken bandstand and, as the name suggests, dog shit. One of the programmes Sam helped set up was to turn this ugly wasteland into a garden full of flowers and vegetables. They had one member of staff to coordinate, but otherwise it was up to a group of about 20 volunteer patients who were depressed or suffering from other forms of distress. "It's yours," they said. "Help us to make it beautiful." On that first day, Lisa looked at the scrubland and looked at the other volunteers, and the thought that they were responsible for this made her seize up with anxiety. How, in 2 days a week, were they going to make anything work? Her heart began to thump. She made very nervous and halting conversation with the other members of the group. She met a white working-class man who told her he'd dropped out of school when he was really young. Later, the doctors told Lisa that for years he'd come in to see them and been threatening and aggressive, and they thought twice before even letting him in the programme. She met Mr. Singh, an elderly Asian man who said he'd travelled the world and began to tell fantastical stories about where he'd been. There were two people with serious learning difficulties, and there were some middle-class people who couldn't shake off their own blues. Lisa looked at them and thought, there's nowhere else in London where we would all be talking to each other. But they agreed they had a common goal, to make this park nice for people to walk through. In those first few months, they began to learn about seeds and plants, and they discussed what they wanted the park to look like. They were city people. They didn't have a clue. They had, they realised, to learn about nature. It was a slow process. 1 week they'd plant something and expect it to grow, but nothing came. It was only when they sank their fingers into the earth and realised that in one part of the alley they had been planting on clay that they saw their mistake. They began, as the weeks passed, to see that they would have to learn the rhythms of the seasons and the earth beneath their feet. They decided to plant daffodils and key shrubs and seasonal flowers. At first it was slow and difficult. They realised, there's something about nature, Lisa told me. You can't change how nature is, because the weather will do that, the seasons will do that. So you can plant things, and either they'll fail or they'll succeed. You have to learn how to do that. You have to learn to be patient. It's not a quick fix. Creating a garden takes time, an investment of energy and a commitment. You might not feel you've made much impact in one gardening session, but if you do that every week, over a period of time, you'll see a change. She was going to learn, as she said, it's about commitment to something that might take a long time and having the patience to do that. Normally, depressed or anxious people, when they're offered treatment beyond drugs, are put in a position where they have to talk about how they feel, but that's often the last thing they want to do. Their feelings are unbearable. Here, they had a place where there was something slow and steady to do, and there was no pressure to talk about anything but that. But as they began to trust one another, they would talk about how they felt, at a pace they felt comfortable with. Lisa began to explain her story to the members of the group she liked. In turn, they began to explain things back to her. And what Lisa realised is that everyone there had understandable reasons to feel terrible. One of the men who came to the group was, he told Lisa quietly, sleeping on the number 25 bus every night. The drivers knew he was homeless, so they didn't throw him off. Lisa looked at him and thought, How could you avoid depression in a situation like that? Just like the doctors in Cambodia who realised the farmer needed a cow, Lisa realised that many of the depressed members of the gardening group needed practical solutions. So she started to phone and harass the council until they finally agreed to house this man. In the months that followed, he became less depressed. As time passed, the group began to see their flowers bloom. People started to walk through the park, and they would thank this group, who'd been shut away, feeling useless, for so long, for what they were doing. One old white woman would always stop on her way home from shopping and give some of the Bengali women in the group money to plant more flowers. Mr. Singh, the elderly Bengali man, would talk to the group about how these plants were connected to everything in the universe, part of a cosmic plan. They began to feel, in their modest ways, that they had a purpose, that they could do something. One day, another member of the group asked Lisa how she'd become depressed, and when she explained, he said, "You were bullied at work. I was bullied at work." Later, he told her it was a key moment in his life. "I realised you are the same as me," he said. As she told me that, Lisa teared up. "Oh, Jesus Christ," she said. "But that's what the project was about, really." For many members of the group, two forms of deep disconnection were being healed. The first was disconnection from other people. There's a cafe in the Bromley by Bow Centre that Sam runs, and they would sit there together after the gardening sessions, and after a few months, Lisa realised she was almost shouting, because it was such a relief, after so long, to finally be talking to people again. She had been terrified to leave her front door, and crushingly self-conscious in front of people, but now, she'd been helped over that initial threshold, she realised. She says, "I was really almost desperate to reconnect with people." As she engaged with their problems and their joy, she says, "I stopped obsessing about me so much. I had other people to worry about." Phil, the angry young white guy who the doctors had been a little afraid of, who they were wary of putting into the program at all, took the two people with learning difficulties under his wing. He was the first to make sure they were included in everything and to help them. And he was the first who suggested they should all study for a certification in horticulture, which the group then embarked on together. The second form of disconnection that was being healed, Lisa believes, was from nature. There's something about engaging in the natural environment, even if it's a little scrubby patch in a really urban area, she says. "I was just reconnecting with the earth and noticing little things. You stop hearing the airplanes and the traffic and you get a sense of just how tiny we are, our insignificance." Later she said, "It was actually getting my hands dirty, literally getting them dirty, that helped her to discover a sense of place. It wasn't just me, there's the sky. Out there there's the sun. It isn't all about me, right? It isn't all about my battle with injustices. There's a wider picture here, and I need to be part of that again." That's how I felt, sitting on the paving in this garden with my hands in the flower bed. Because of this modest little program, she said, those two things that I'd completely lost contact with, people and nature, had come back into my life again. It felt to Lisa like, as the garden came to life, the members of the group came back to life. They felt proud of something they'd done for the first time in years. They'd made something beautiful. When I went to walk through the garden they had built, I felt a sense of serenity in this little green oasis with a bubbling fountain in this lumbering, polluted lump of East London where I had lived for so long. After she had been in the gardening program for a few years, Lisa stopped taking Prozac, and over the next few years, she lost 4.5 stone, 62 pounds in weight. She'd met a gardener who she fell in love with, a man called Ian, and after a few years more, she moved away to a village in Wales, where by the time I met her, she was about to open a gardening centre of her own. She's still in touch with some of the people from the gardening group. They saved each other, she told me. Them and the soil. As I talked with Lisa for hours over an East London breakfast of sausages and chips, she told me that some people might misunderstand the lesson from the gardening group. "It isn't something that just happens," she said. "I think if you're depressed, you can't just go out and find a bit of garden and get stuck in and you'll feel better. It has to be managed and supported. If people merely say, 'Oh, just go sit in the park, you'll feel better, go for a walk in the woods, you'll feel better,' yeah, of course that's true, but someone has to help you do it. She could never have done it alone. It took a doctor to prescribe it, to talk her gently through its medical value and to urge her on for it to happen. Without it, she fears, she might still be shut away in that house, guzzling Ben and Jerry's, afraid to be seen, slowly shutting down. At the reception desk of the Bromley by Bow Centre, I saw when I first went there that you could be referred to a doctor or to one of more than 100 social programs that work out of here, offering everything from pottery to exercise classes to going out into the community to help other people. If you go in to see a doctor, you'll find it looks a little different from any other doctor's office I've been to. The doctor doesn't sit behind a desk with a screen in front of him or her. You sit side by side together. This, Sam tells me, is one small expression of a subtly different way of thinking about health. He was trained as a doctor, he says, to act as the person who had the knowledge. The patient comes in, describes some symptoms, you do some tests, and then you pronounce what's wrong and how to solve it. There are some instances where that's the right approach, he says. You got a chest infection, you need an antibiotic, bang, bang, there's clarity. But the vast majority of the time, it's not like that. Most people come to their doctor because they're distressed. Even when you have a physical pain, like a bad knee, that will feel far worse if you have nothing else in your life and no connections. Almost all his consultations, he says, are in part about the emotional health of the patient. The biggest job of the doctor is to listen. He says he's learned, especially with depression and anxiety, to shift from asking, what's the matter with you, to what matters to you. If you want to find a solution, you need to listen to what's missing in the depressed or anxious person's life and help them find a way towards solving that. The doctors at Bromley by Bow do prescribe chemical antidepressants, and they defend them and believe they work, but they only see that as one small part of the picture and not a long-term solution. Saul Marmot, another doctor there, told me, there's no point putting sticking plasters over the patient's pain. No, what you've got to do is tackle the reasons why they're there in the first place. Later, he said, there's no point in using antidepressants if nothing has changed, so that when they come off the antidepressant, they're still in the same place they were before. Something's got to change, or you're going to go back. Often, the patients come in, just as I did, believing their depression is purely physical, a brain malfunction. Sam starts by explaining two things to them, both of which can be surprising. First, he tells them that there's a lot doctors don't know about depression and anxiety, and that this is a complex question, so they'll have to work with the patient to get to the bottom of it. He says, it's our fundamental philosophy, having the humility to say, I don't know. It's really important. It's the most important thing you could say. And by the way, you will increase the trust a patient has in you by saying that. And then he tells them about how, after he got divorced a few years ago, he became profoundly anxious all the time for several years. It can, he says, happen to anyone. You're not alone. There's something about saying, it's okay, Sam says. I hesitate to use the word normal, but it's normal. If, by contrast, Sam told you just that you have a problem inside your brain, he said then, you have no control over it and there's nothing you can do about it. That's clearly utter nonsense. And how does that set you up in the longer term? When you're depressed, he says, you're in a very dark place. And if you can give somebody a taste of recovery, even if it's a small taste, just that small hope, a bit of hope, is absolutely critical, and you never know where that hope is going to come from. So he lays out a big, broad menu of small steps they can take back to reconnection. He tries to model that connection when he talks to his patients. Part of his job, he says, is to be a friend. He lives just a few hundred yards from the centre. He's available, and he says another key part of the centre's philosophy is any excuse for a party. They're always finding some reason to have a celebration with all their patients invited. Sam calls this approach social prescribing, and it spurred a real debate. The potential advantages are obvious. Sam's Health Trust alone spends £1 million a year, which is about $1.2 million US dollars, providing chemical antidepressants to 17,000 patients, with limited results. Sam suspects that social prescribing can get the same or better results for significantly less money. So for years, the Bromley by Bow Centre and other groups doing social prescribing have been patiently gathering data, hoping that academics would come to study what they're doing. But little research has been done so far. Why? It's the same story I've been hearing everywhere. Giving people drugs for depression and anxiety is one of the biggest industries in the world. So there are enormous funds sloshing around to finance research into it. And that research is often distorted, as I learned. Social prescribing, if it's successful, wouldn't make much money. In fact, it would blast a hole in that multi-billion dollar chemical market. There would be less profit. So none of the vested interests want to know. There has, however, been a series of scientific studies of what's called therapeutic horticulture, getting people to try gardening to improve their mental health. None of the studies have been carried out in especially big groups or for a long time, and the studies aren't perfectly designed, so we should handle them with some skepticism. But the results suggest there's something there we should be looking at more. One study of depressed people in Norway found that a program like this moved people on average 4.5 points on the depression scale, more than double the effect of chemical antidepressants. Another study of young women suffering from severe anxiety found similar results. This suggests, at the very least, that it's a good place to start planting the seeds of research. I went back to see Michael Marmot, the social scientist who first discovered that meaningless work makes us depressed. He'd begun on his journey, as you might remember, in a clinic in Sydney, where he watched while people came into his hospital depressed because their lives were lousy, only to be given a bottle of white mixture and told to go home. Michael, I knew, had visited and informally advised the Bromley by Bow Centre over the years, and I wanted to hear what he had to say about it. He told me that what they are doing is simple. When people come to them with a physical problem, they treat the physical problem. But much, perhaps most of the problems we visit the doctor with are not like that. When people come to them with a problem in living, he said, they try to address the problem in living. Sam, the doctor who helped transform this clinic, told me he suspects that a century from now, we will look back on the discovery that you need to meet people's emotional needs if you want them to recover from depression and anxiety as a key moment in medical history. Until the 1850s, nobody knew what caused cholera, and it killed enormous numbers of people. Then a physician named John Snow discovered, just a few miles from Sam's clinic, coincidentally, that the disease is carried in water, and we started to build proper sewage systems. As a result, cholera outbreaks in the West stopped. An antidepressant, they've learned, isn't just a pill. It's anything that lifts your despair. The evidence that chemical antidepressants don't work for most people shouldn't make us give up on the idea of an antidepressant, but it should make us look for better antidepressants. And they may not look anything like we've been trained to think of them by Big Pharma. Saul Marmot, one of the general practitioners there, told me the benefits of the approach they've adopted at Bromley by Bow are so obvious, I don't know why I couldn't see it before, and I don't know why the whole of society can't see it. While we talked, Sam Everington and I were sitting in the centre's busy cafe, and people kept interrupting us to talk to him or hug him. That's the woman who teaches people how to paint windows, he said to me at one point. That's the man who used to be a police officer who came here as part of his job, fell in love with it, and now works here. It's funny, he says, to see the teenagers come and ask his advice for what somebody should hypothetically do to avoid a hypothetical crime. As Sam waved to yet another person, he told me something. What he has learned is that when you can become connected to the people around you, he said, it's restoring of human nature. Sitting in this web of reawakened connections, a woman at the table next to us, who had been listening to our conversation, smiled at him and to herself. Sam looked at her, and he smiled back. Chapter 18, Reconnection 3 to Meaningful Work. Whenever I became optimistic about the chances of this reconnection spreading beyond isolated points of light like Cotty in Berlin or the Bromley by Bow Clinic in East London, I came back to a huge obstacle. And for a long time, I couldn't see how we get beyond it. We spend most of our waking lives working, and 87% of us either feel disengaged or enraged by our jobs. You are twice as likely to hate your job as love it. And once you factor in emails, those work hours are spreading over more and more of our lives, 50, 60 hours a week. This isn't a molehill. It's the mountain at the center of almost all our lives. This is where our time goes and our lives go. So yeah, you can tell people to try alternatives, to reach out. But when exactly are they meant to do it? In the 4 hours when they collapse onto the sofa and try to engage with their kids before they clamber into bed before it starts all over again. But that's not the obstacle I was thinking of. The obstacle is that meaningless work has to be done. It's not like some of the other causes of depression and anxiety I've been talking about, like childhood trauma or extreme materialism, which are unnecessary malfunctions in the wider system. Work is essential. I thought about all the jobs all my relatives have done. My maternal grandmother cleaned toilets. My maternal grandfather worked on the docks.